Stalin was feeling better, but he had mulled angrily over the challenges from abroad, indiscipline at home, disloyalty in his circle. He was bored and depressed by stillness and solitude. His angry energy and zest for life were stimulated by struggle. Returning in December with a glint in his yellow eyes and a spring in his step, he resolved to reinvigorate Bolshevism and to diminish his overmighty boyars in a deft sweep of demotions and arrests. Having shaken Molotov, Stalin turned on Beria and Malenkov. He did not need to invent the scandal. Nearly half the losses of Soviet planes during the war were due to mechanical failure, not enemy fire or pilot error. Stalin ordered Abakumov, the Smersh boss, to investigate an aviator's case against Shakurin, the aircraft production minister, and the Air Force commander, Air Marshal Novikov, whom he had jokingly threatened at de Gaulle's banquet. Beria and Malenkov were promoted to full Politburo membership, just as the aviator's case nipped at their heels. Shakurin and Air Marshal Novikov were arrested and tortured. Their agonies were carefully directed at the overlord of aircraft production, Malenkov. The aviator's case was also aimed at Beria. Stalin's old fondness for the Mingrelian had long since turned to a surly disdain. Beria's theatrical sycophancy and murderous creativity disgusted Stalin as much as his administrative genius impressed him. Stalin no longer trusted Snake Eyes. They were strolling in the Kuntsevo Gardens when Stalin hissed venomously at Beria in the Mingrelian dialect, which no one except Georgians understood, "You traitor, Lavrenti Beria." Then he added, with an ironic smile, "Traitor." When he dined at Beria's house, he was charming to Nina, but dismissive of Lavrenti. In his toasts, he damned Beria with the faintest of praise. Stalin moved swiftly. Beria was retired as MVD minister. Then Stalin, backed by Zhdanov, engineered the promotion of Abakumov to Minister of State Security. Abakumov remains the most shadowy of Stalin's secret peace bosses, just as the post-war years remained the murkiest of Stalin's reign. The coming atrocities were Abakumov's doing, not Beria's, even though most histories blame the latter. Beria, who, as deputy premier in charge of the bomb, now moved his office from the Lubyanka to the Kremlin, was henceforth sacked from the secret police. He bitterly resented it. Like a rat on a sinking ship, Beria's pimp, Colonel Sarkisov, denounced the sexual degeneracy of the Bolshevik Bluebeard to Abakumov, who eagerly took it to Stalin. "Bring me everything this arsehole will write down," snapped Stalin. As Abakumov was promoted, Malenkov was abruptly removed from the secretariat. He was dispatched to check the harvest in Central Asia for several months, but never arrested. Beria tried to persuade Stalin to bring him back, which amused the generalissimo. "Why are you taking such trouble with that imbecile? You'll be the first to be betrayed by him." The success of the bomb was now paramount to Beria. He rushed to see Professor Kurchatov's experimental nuclear reactor go critical, creating the first Soviet self-sustaining nuclear reaction. Beria watched Kurchatov raise the control rod of the panel and listened to the clicks that registered the neutrons rise to a wail. "Is that all?" barked Beria, afraid of being tricked. "Nothing more? Can I go to the reactor?" This would have been a delicious prospect for Beria's millions of victims, but the scientists dutifully restrained him. The decline of Beria and Malenkov marked the resurrection of their enemy, Andrei Zhdanov, Stalin's special friend, that hearty, pretentious intellectual who, after the stress of Leningrad, was a plump alcoholic with watery eyes and a livid complexion. Stalin now talked openly about Zhdanov as his successor, and promoted him to party deputy in charge of both agitprop and relations with foreign parties. Zhdanov consolidated his triumph over Malenkov and Beria by persuading Stalin to promote his own camarilla of Leningraders to power in Moscow. Alexei Kuznetsov, the hero of the siege, received Malenkov's secretaryship, which earned him the undying hatred of both Malenkov and Beria, the two most vindictive predators in the Stalinist jungle. By February 1946, with Stalin in semi-retirement, Zhdanov seemed to have control of the party as well as cultural and foreign policy matters, and to have neutralized the secret police and the military. His staff whispered about our crown prince. Stalin toyed with appointing him general secretary. At the November parade, Zhdanov, in Stalin's absence, took the salute, with his Leningraders filling the mausoleum. Yet his health was weak. Zhdanov never wanted to be the successor. During Stalin's serious illnesses, he was terrified at the prospect, telling his son, "God forbid I outlive Stalin." Stalin and Zhdanov picked up where they had left off before the war, debating how to merge the patriotic Russianness of the war with the Bolshevism of the revolution in order to eradicate foreign influence and restore morality, pride, and discipline. They devised a savage attack on modernism and foreign influence on Russian culture, and a crackdown on the cultural freedom of wartime. The Leningrad journals were the natural place to start, because they published the works of the satirist Mikhail Zoshenko, whom Stalin had once read to his children, and the poetess Anna Akhmatova, whose passionate verses symbolized the indestructible dignity and sensitivity of humanity in terror and war. Zhdanov launched his cultural terror, known as Zhdanovshina, with an attack on the journals. He traveled to Leningrad to demand how weak was the vigilance of those citizens in Leningrad in the leadership of the journal Zvezda, for it to publish works poisoned with the venom of zoological hostility to the Soviet leadership. He castigated Akhmatova as this half-nun, half-harlot, or rather harlot-nun whose sin is mixed with prayer, a grotesque distortion of her own verses. He followed this up with attacks on filmmakers and musicians. At a notorious meeting with Shostakovich and others, Zhdanov tinkled on the piano to demonstrate easily hummed people's tunes, a vision as absurd as Joseph II admonishing Mozart for writing too many notes. Bantering playfully, the omnipotent double act, Stalin and Zhdanov, held conversazione to guide writers and film directors. On the night of the 14th of May, 1947, they received Stalin's two favored literary bureaucrats, the poet Simonov and the hack novelist Fadyeyev, the head of the Writers' Union. Stalin asked, "What kind of themes are writers working on?" He launched into a lecture about Soviet patriotism. The people were proud, but our middle intelligentsia, doctors and professors, don't have patriotic education. They have unjustified admiration for foreign culture. The spirit of self-abasement must be destroyed. You should write a novel on this theme. Stalin had a recent scandal in mind. Two Soviet cancer specialists had published their work in an American journal. Stalin and Zhdanov had created Courts of Honor, a throwback to the Tsarist officer class, to try the professors. Stalin set Simonov to write a play about the case. Zhdanov spent an entire hour giving literary criticism to Simonov before Stalin himself rewrote the play's ending. In August, Bolshakov, the cinematic impresario, showed Stalin a new movie, Ivan the Terrible, Part 2. Knowing from NGV reports that Eisenstein compared Ivan with Yezhov, Stalin rejected this nightmare, hating its lack of Russian pride and its portrayal of the Tsar. Eisenstein shrewdly appealed to Stalin, visiting the little corner with his scriptwriter, where Stalin and Zhdanov gave them a masterclass on national Bolshevism, a most revealing tour d'horizon of history, terror, and even sex. Stalin attacked the film. "Your Tsar is indecisive. He resembles Hamlet. Tsar Ivan was a great, wise ruler, wise not to let foreigners into the country. Historical figures," he added, "must be shown correctly. Ivan the Terrible kissed his wife too long. It wasn't permitted at that time." Then came the crux. "Ivan the Terrible was very cruel," said Stalin. "You can show he was cruel, but you must show why he needed to be cruel." Then Zhdanov raised the crucial question of Ivan's beard. Eisenstein promised to shorten it. Eisenstein asked if he could smoke. "It seems to me there's no ban on smoking. Maybe we'll vote on it." Stalin smiled at Eisenstein. "I don't give you instructions. I merely give you the comments of a viewer." Zhdanov's campaign to promote Russian patriotism was soon so absurd that Sakharov remembered how people would joke about Russia, homeland of the elephant. More ominously, the unleashing of Russian nationalism and the attacks on cosmopolitans turned against the Jews.